Welcome back to the Download here on 720 WGN. I'm Justin Coffin. Well, my guest tonight at the big table is one of the best film directors working today, and he's got the Oscars, the Golden Globes, and the BAFTAs to prove it. Danny Boyle is in Chicago to promote the new film T2 Trainspotting, the highly anticipated sequel to the groundbreaking original, starring Ewan McGregor and Robert Carlyle, among others, based on the books by Irvin Welsh, who was just in here just last month. It's hard to believe that it's been over 20 years since Trainspotting was released, and the sequel picks back up 20-plus years later as the characters of Renton, Sick Boy, Franco, and Spud are reunited, and the film does not disappoint. It's my pleasure to welcome award-winning director Danny Boyle to the big table tonight. Mr. Boyle, thanks for being here. Appreciate it.
Hey, thank you. Thanks, Justin. Very nice to be here.
This is, I mean, technically it's a sequel. But yeah. Let's talk about these reuniting these characters, because, you know, there's something about the idea that, yes, it's a sequel, but it is a new movie because you're dealing with characters that have grown over 20 years' time.
Yeah, they're so different. It's not like a traditional sequel where you kind of rehash everything, the ingredients, you know, you have a new plot, a bit of a new caper. And indeed, we tried that at one point, and it was terrible. You thought, if we're going to go back to these guys, given the impact of the first film, you're going to have something new to say about them, some progression, you know, something that's both just literally materially different in front of you. And of course, it's age.
Yeah.
Because it is 20 years plus, really, in the typical hapless fashion of the characters. We missed the 20th anniversary by about 3 months.
That's true.
But there you go. They would be kind of proud of that. They would say, there you go. And it's the I guess what it is, it sort of was weird doing it because it focused the first film. It made you realize what the first film was about, because there was quite a lot of controversy at the time that was saying, is it about drugs?
Yeah, it's about heroin or
is it about friendship?
Right.
But actually what it's about, you realize when you look back at it and you make another one later, is it was about boyhood, really. And the kind of men's love, boys, youths, love, males, youth, love of that energy and carelessness and recklessness of your early 20s, and you kind of take appalling risks with yourself and your friends, and some don't make it. But even the ones that don't make it, you kind of tip your hat, but you move on. You don't really dwell on it, not really.
Yeah.
You just kind of career onwards. And then, that's what it looked like now when we look back at that film, because now it's what that's like when you get to 46, and can you still do the same? And men typically try to relive constantly the past, won't grow up or won't move forward like women accuse us of the whole time. And women deal with age so much better than we deal with it, you know? So it's kind of in that territory where the film's
it's
about.
It's fascinating to me because it really is. I mean, I can't think of any art like this or film where the actual actors are the same, the 20 years later. I mean, everything about it is capturing and really in exploring the idea that these characters had to grow. And they had ups and they had downs, and they lived, they take those with. So it's the same actors, it's Ewan McGregor again, yeah. But he's got that feeling, you got the feeling that Renton has lived 20 years of life. And that adds to, it's a different character.
Yes, he's got a very, very big crisis as well, which happens in the first shot of the film you see, which triggers this return of his from Amsterdam to Edinburgh, where he had abandoned his mates and stole their money.
Yeah, that's how the first movie ends, right?
Yeah, that's at the end. He literally walked out on them, and now he walks back in on them, really, with a mystery, really, about what has happened to him and why he has come back. And he's come back for, well, you have to see the film, but he's come back for highly critical reasons, really, acute reasons of crisis, really, for himself. And he finds his mates almost in a state of status. Begbie's been in prison for 20 years. Spud's been on and off drugs, really, in the same state, somehow has survived. And Sick Boy continues to scam in ever-decreasing circles, you know?
I mean, it's fascinating, and it's a tremendous accomplishment to be able to get the actors back together, to get them back together with you. You know, talk about those characters. What drew you? I mean, you talked a lot about, you know, why you did the film in the first place, why you based it on Irvin's work. But what drew you to doing it again, and what drew you to the new characters 20 years plus?
I think it was that people kept talking about them. And like, you do films, and if you're lucky, some of them are successful, and anyway, whether you're lucky or not, some of them are unsuccessful. But they all fade away over time,
right,
gently. They kind of just like have a half-life that just diminishes gently into the background. But this one didn't. It sort of stayed there.
Why do you think that is?
Well, people would talk to you about the characters, and they remembered their names. And nobody remembers characters' names from movies. You remember the actor, maybe, but you never remember what their character name was. And people would come up to me on the tube in London and have this conversation with me about Renton and Spud. And I'd be like, and I couldn't remember a lot of the details of the film, and they could, you know, and they were like, so there was this quality about it that it was still felt alive. And then Irvin, bless him, published a kind of 10 years later sequel book called Porno. And so we felt obliged, really, to have a go at adapting it. And we did. And it wasn't very good. And we learnt something from that. Because I think it was okay, but it was a rehash. And it was just the same territory again. And so it was really just a different caper, really. And we decided not to do it. And we didn't even send it to the actors. And then when the 20-year anniversary came about, we met. And I think when we started the meeting, we met for a week in Edinburgh. I didn't think we were going to... I think we thought this will be it. We just won't be able to do it. We'll walk away. Mm-hmm. And something came out a bit more personal about age, particularly from John Hodge, the screenwriter, mm-hmm. and myself, and that formed it, really, that actually took it into a place where... Well, it's what you see in the cinema, yeah. really, which is this this transition, which is male behaviour over extended time, really.
And the idea, and in a way, I mean, that you can't go back home. You can't try to go back to being 22 years old. And it seems like all the characters in the film, they almost all of them want to go back. They want to go back to a different life, and it's always fleeting.
It's classic. They behave as though they can. Yeah, they yeah. try to. And that gives us, that's very advantageous to us as filmmakers, because it lets us have a bit of the same of the old movie, because they try to recreate it literally. And there's a great scene in the Loyalist Club yeah. where they sing this No More Catholic song,
right.
which is a bit of a riot, very offensive to everybody, typical, bit like the first film. So you get the flavour of the same kind of thing as they try right. to recreate the effortless bravado of the past. But there's also the new material, which is focused around children, actually. There are some children in the film who belong, that they've fathered since we saw them, and for whom they are very disappointing fathers. And there's a couple of imaginary children as well, which is also extraordinary in a way. Like yeah. you think, what's going on there? So a lot of it is that as they begin to, and they do move. They imagine that, well, they try to recreate the opportunity and betrayal of the first film,
right,
literally.
Right.
There's some more money on offer, and they don't seem to learn.
They don't learn anything.
They're just trying to work out how to cheat each other out of it. And actually, they get cheated out of it by somebody entirely different, and justice is served, really. And they're left with nothing apart from the opportunity to begin to atone for where they are and what they've done. And there is a movement. It is very poignant, actually. It's surprisingly emotional as they move yeah. towards some kind of acknowledgement of where they are.
Award-winning film director Danny Boyle in studio. T2 Trainspotting is in theaters March 24th. Let's take a quick break. We'll come back more with Danny Boyle here on The Download. Stay with us. Welcome back to The Download here on 720 WGN. I'm Justin Kaufman. In studio with me, Danny Boyle, the award-winning director, film director, of course. So many great credits to your name, including the new movie T2 Trainspotting, the Trainspotting sequel, 20-plus years later, if you call it that, but out in theaters this weekend. I got to say, I am one of the great things about the characters is that they don't follow this sort of Hollywood arc. They're not anti-heroes that turn to heroes. They're not, we do heroin and now we learned our lesson. There's something about it that the despicable part of nature that is within, I would say, all of us, but within these characters, it's unapologetic.
Yeah.
What draws you to that? What about that? Because you've been able to do that with a lot of your work, is to bring characters out that aren't necessarily the prototype or the stereotype of a certain situation.
In this case, it was to do with Irvin's first book, Trainspotting, which I think when we all read it back in 95, it felt like you'd found Ulysses or a modern Ulysses. It was extraordinary because he, front and centre, unapologetically, as you say, characters who are normally on the margins, who are viewed as victims or idiots or evil.
Or the villains, right.
Yeah. And they're viewed like that. And he put them front and centre, said, no, not only do they have a point of view, and the point of view is acutely about drugs, mm-hmm. and it's complex and difficult to take on board from the traditional moral landscape of condemning drugs, but this is their world. And not only that, they've got a sense of humour that's going to make you really want to know them. And of course, that's what you get with them, the chaos, the sense of humour that makes you like them. Even Begbie, who is the terrible person. You know, you can't possibly terrible. Like Begbie. But in Bobby Carlyle's hands, you're terrified.
He's the favourite.
And you quite like him.
You quite like him.
You know, it's like, and it happens in this movie as well. He's awful, but you think...
He's awful, he's terrible, but he's also the comic relief in the way that he sort of lives his life. But he's a very dangerous character.
We all know somebody like that. Yes. Not to that extreme, obviously. But you know, within your mates, you've got those characters, yeah. You know. So I think that's that. There are archetypes, brilliant archetypes that Irving's drawn.
I was watching an interview today, earlier, to get ready for this, and you talked about, it was in reference to you doing Frankenstein, the stage work. But you said in the stage work, it's the actor's job to tell the story. In film, it's the director's job. You're using the actors as vessels, using the characters as vessels. Yeah. But at the end of the day, you're the one telling the stories in the edit.
Yes.
Trainspotting tells a story of these four characters, others in Edinburgh, on, as you said, on the margins. But it's the style in which it's told. And it's the film, the directing, the way the stuff stopped, the music was used. The style that came out of that in 20 years ago, 1996, was something that was unique and brand new to us. Talk about that. Talk about your style, bringing that to Trainspotting. How you feel that, you know, you even mentioned it in the last segment, it's still, people are still talking about it 20 years from now.
But it emerges out of what's around at the time. And that's two things. One, it's the characters, and you try and get as much of it to emerge from the actors and the characters as possible, because then it feels locked in. It feels part of the DNA of the film. It doesn't feel like a style that's imposed on the actors, which can happen, because they actually give you the style in a way. So it's coming from them. And it's a quid pro quo. You give a bit and you get a bit back. So, and they see what you're doing and they up their game a little bit towards it, towards that style. So you chase that style with them a bit more. So you get it from them. That's the one thing. And the other thing is you get it from the time. And at the time, MTV was beginning to announce itself. And we were beginning to watch more and more pop videos. And I used to love them. And people said, you can't do that in a movie. That's terrible. Movies are classical. And I was like, well, not really. I mean, I love a classical movie, but actually I really, really, really love an MTV pop video as well. And so you kind of made a kind of like a hybrid of that. So it came out at the time as well. I mean, that's gone away a bit now, really, the pop videos. But if you remember at the time, it was a wonderful exploratory time. It was pushing the frontiers of what you can do with music. And then you harness that music to character. And you've got a really wonderful combination.
Was it tough for you as a new filmmaker? It's only your second movie, to push that envelope, to try new things, to do things that the establishment in the UK or even in Hollywood were like, you don't do that in movies.
We'd had a bit of a success with the first film, Shallow Grave, and that gives you a bit of freedom if you don't take too much money. And we didn't take a lot of money for Trainspotting because it was a very odd book to adapt. Nobody thought that it would work. Drug movies don't work generally, and especially when they're in thick Scottish accents, you know, that it's not going to travel, you know. And of course, ironically, it did. But we maintained control by not getting greedy, and that allowed us to have a kind of freedom. And then it's the chemistry of those four and five actors. And it was just that money can't buy that. Only luck buys that. You have a great casting director, but even she doesn't know when they come. She knows they're great actors individually,
but how they're going to work together.
But how it'll work when they get together. And also, three of them are Scottish, one of them isn't. That doesn't really make sense. And yet they're all playing Scottish. I mean, it was like a bizarre kind of wonderful coincidence that we bumped into each other, you know. And coming back to it 20 years later, that we just picked it up off the floor as though we'd just put it down.
It's amazing. It's amazing that not only do the characters, you know, obviously the chemistry was great in 1996, but to come back 20 years later and to feel that as the audience, that the characters, they really, truly were boyhood friends.
Yeah.
You know, the time has elapsed. It's really wonderful. One of the characters in the film, when the first film and the second film, is Edinburgh. The stylized, the way that Edinburgh played in the first one and these characters were on the margins was tremendous, to be able to see that iconic city and see it with these guys, you know, doing their thing inside of it. This movie does the same thing. I mean, you have a great scene where Renton and Spud go up Arthur's seat and sit at the top, and you're able to see it. And it almost once again brings that contradiction, that juxtaposition, that this is a beautiful city, arts and culture, mecca of the UK, and these are the characters that live in it.
Yeah, these are the guys on the margins, which is why Irvine, it was so revolutionary for Irvine to say, hey, you know your Edinburgh Festival, which is meant to be radical, here's radical from your own back garden. And he exploded these guys and his stories literally injected them into the town, into the town.
Could you
center.
Do Trainspotting anywhere else? Does it have to be in Edinburgh? Could you have done it in Atlanta, Georgia? Could you have done it in a different UK town?
I suppose you should answer that you could. I wouldn't be able to. Because it feels so wrapped up in the language. He's so proud of the language.
Yeah.
It's so uncompromising, the linguistic challenge of reading the books, which is, once you unlock it, of course, it's delicious. Because it's like you can read French suddenly. It literally is. It's English, but not in the fashion that you know it. But once it unlocks, it's like you can read a foreign language over, without having to put any work in. You know, and I love that about it. You know, it's such a kind of slap in the face for correct English, you know, what's regarded as correct English. And of course, it came out of the destruction, the demolition of working class communities. These were the last vestiges of them, and it manifested itself in Edinburgh in a heroin epidemic in the 80s, when heroin was the HIV capital of Europe. And he wrote these stories about it. He didn't write these pitying stories, you know, liberal stories about guilt and worry about victims. He wrote this defiant scream from these people with a sense of humour, and an appalling sense of humour. This, because of course their humour is absolute, they'll laugh about anything,
right?
You know, which is a tradition we continue in the new film as well.
It's great. Filmmaker Danny Boyle in studio. T2 Trainspotting in theaters this weekend. Okay, let's take a quick break. We'll get an update on tonight's news. We'll come back. Danny Boyle in studio. Stay with us. Welcome back to The Download here on 720 WGN. I'm Justin Kaufman. My guest in studio at the big table tonight, award-winning film director Danny Boyle, T2 Trainspotting in theaters this weekend, the long-awaited sequel to one of the most iconic films, of my generation. I was 21 years old. When I saw that movie, I was like, you're in a point where you're looking for something else. You're looking for a different alternative. Yeah. You're looking for underground movies, the My Own Private Idahos, if you will. You know, you're looking for other stuff. And to find Trainspotting, and even though it was a story about the guys on the margins of Edinburgh, Scotland, it resonated with this kid from Chicago. What do you think that's about? Why do you think it resonated with so many people in the States, around the world, that didn't know anything about Scottish culture or Edinburgh or anything in the UK?
I think it is that what you just said at the beginning, you emerge out of your boyhood, really, into a kind of early manhood. And you're kind of looking around for something that lets you object to what's been offered, to the customary stuff that's offered you, a conventional career, you know, mapped out for you, everything will be as planned as your father did it, and you're looking for something different. And we tolerate it, actually, because it's an important element of development, that rejection, that feeling of questioning, really. And here, it's done by these guys who are at their most acute, and it's expressed, of course, most sardonically and ironically by Renton's Choose Life speech,
right,
where he says, all these choices you're offering me.
All these choices.
Yeah, and then, of course, in the new film, there's an update of that, because, of course, you're doing a sequel. Everybody says, there's going to be an update, yeah, of the Choose Life speech. Yeah. So there is an update of it, but it's interesting, because it appears to be, you know, a litany of updates. You know, it's more social media these days rather than washing machines.
It fits.
But it's a confession as well, actually. It's an angry confession from him that his own choices have resulted in disappointment for him, and that he stands now as a man who has lost some people that he loved, most notably his mother, whose funeral he's not gone back for, and Tommy, and we hear about that when they go to the Scottish countryside once again, and that has consequences that you see played out, and that he's not become the person that he wanted to become, really. And it's a part of a process of atonement for him eventually to arrive, because he appears to have nothing, really, as he says. If you see the film, his relationship in Amsterdam has broken down, and he appears to be left with nothing, and he's 46. And he has a very choice use of words to express what he thinks about being 46.
But that's a lot of us. I mean, I think of my generation. I'm 42 years old, and I feel like at that time, like watching that movie, it meant everything to say, oh, this is against the grain. This is what I'm talking about. I choose life. And to be 42 and watch this, I'm like, I did choose life. And here I have some of the same things that these guys are going through, is the consequence of choosing life. One of the things I was going to ask about was, it is interesting because The one thing about Trainspotting that we loved was the fact that it did take on issues like heroin use. But the way that movies would take on heroin use was almost like a cautionary tale.
Yeah.
Or something, a figure of some sort saying this is bad and see what's going to happen to you. Almost a director or just the idea of the film in general. This film didn't do that. This film said, yeah, there's a lot of consequences to doing these drugs. But it's almost the side thing to what these guys were about. And so in a way, I feel like that's also goes to the idea of giving us something different, something that was against the grain when it comes to filmmaking.
Yeah, it didn't try to patronize people
right.
about drugs because you, especially that audience, you're talking about people of 21 watching it, it's not patronizing them about drugs. You know, it's because the drugs are a part of their life. At that age, they're going to be part of your life. And what you need is education to be wise about. If you're going to travel that route, you're going to need to be wise with it, really. And also, you've got to accept that drugs will always be with us. You know, you can't. You imagine politicians, because they want to have a soundbite, think that they can just be tough on them and get rid of them. But they've always been with us. And heroin especially is a drug that marches beside humanity. And we turn to it medically when we need it, and we'll probably all die self-administering it. Or certainly if you're in a terrible car accident, you'll use it for amazing and powerful pain relief. And then on the streets, people use it for emotional or psychological pain, really. And that's what they use it for. And of course, the film doesn't shy away, and this one doesn't shy away from the consequences that can be because of that.
Right.
But nor does it say, just because of that, are these people going to solve their problems by just turning away from
right.
it?
They're going to not everything's solved by being in recovery. Not everything's solved
no,
by
I'm afraid not.
Being
no.
sober. Right.
No.
And for you to come back to this story, to come back to T2 Trainspotting, to come back and do 20 years. There's one thing about, you know, what we talked about, what drew you to these characters are coming back. But for you personally, to get back together with this set of actors and the producers and the screenwriters and the crew, I'm sure is similar. What's that like for you? Because you've done so much in your career now, and you've worked with a lot of different people. This is the first kind of foray back to something that was 20 years ago for you personally.
It was, but because it was 20 years, it wasn't just like we can redo that. It was like, well, how are you going to do that? Because it's going to be the same. It's going to be the same actors, but it's got to be different. So how are you going to find that balance of the same and different? And also, how can you create something that will stand beside the other movie? And in a way, that's the toughest thing is to... You know, if you do something poor, you'll get slaughtered, and yeah. quite rightly, because the film is very precious to people. They right. feel like they right. own it. It's not really my film anymore. But you want to create a companion piece to it that allows you to kind of... It allows you to get both films to talk to each other, which they sort of do. Because, as I said, making it, you kind of realise what the first one is about in a way I never really did before. And making this one, when I watched it... in editing, I didn't really understand what it was about. I saw all these children running around. I thought, I'd cast all these children, and directed them. But then when I saw them all together, I thought the film's about, it's about fatherhood, really. And then you get these, Begbie's father makes an appearance as well.
Yeah.
And you have this extraordinary scene of Begbie and his aunt and his son, when he kind of finds somehow a way of apologizing for the way he's been. So it was weird the way you kind of learnt by doing it. It was a kind of, so I suppose one was stepping into, you think it's known because you've done it before, but actually you're stepping into the unknown of how you can actually do it with this 20-year threads connecting the two films and how they'll talk to
Did you flash back to being 20 years younger and say, I mean, have you, all the films that you've done, in between. You've done so many films. You've won Oscars and Slumdog Millionaire, 127 Hours. I mean, you've done so many great films. What from that experience in those 20 years since you've done Trainspotting did you bring back to this project?
I think it's keeping the budget down. It's just a huge... Sounds so simple. It isn't. But it's so fundamental to be able to do what you want to do. And then you've got a big problem about how to make it look like more than $20 million. So we always try and work under $20 million. And then always try and do everything through your characters if you can. No matter how stylish you're being, how flash you're being, all that kind of stuff, do it through the characters. Because you learn over time that no matter what anybody says to you on press junkets or that 99% of people go to the cinema to see characters who they identify with. And they're either like they want to be a bit like them or they don't want to be a bit like them. But they want to see them, and we see.
Yeah.
And it's very primordial. You see ourselves up there as 40-foot high figures doing stupid stuff, being embarrassing, crying, being terrible, evil. And that is a game that we want to see played out, you know. And you do it through the characters, and that's how cinema works. And so you have to cast well, trust your actors, build that faith in them, and they will respond then, and you'll get the best work out of them. And they, and the finest one of them's kind of blow dust off our souls, really, in some way that's not quantifiable, and yet we kind of will always hang on to storytelling as part of our a way forward, I guess.
Danny Boyle, the award-winning, Oscar award-winning film director, so many great films, T2 Trainspotting, the sequel to the tremendous film, does not disappoint. I loved it. I loved coming back and being with those characters again. It was a real great moment for me as someone who really, really enjoyed the first film. Danny, thanks so much for taking some time out and being my guest tonight at the Big Table.
Thanks, Justin. Pleasure.